produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, VR Hoisington and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 390, Gates of Delirium Live, plus Yes author Tim Morse.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 390 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast, and please do, via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week we have a slightly different format to the episode. Mark and I enjoyed listening to three different live versions of The Gates of Delirium a few weeks ago, but we didn't get around to posting our thoughts, so that's what you'll hear first in a few minutes. Then we did a great interview with Yes Book author Tim Morse this week for the Patreon community, and I wanted to include some of that here because Tim once collaborated with John Anderson and also recently released his third solo album, so there's plenty to learn about him. So I've clipped out a few parts of our conversation to play here, and if you want to see the complete video of our chat, including various drinking vessels and Tim's cat, you need to head over to Patreon. If you're already a patron, then it's all there for you, and if you have yet to join in, you can do that at the same time. On the YMP Facebook page this week, Mark shared a review of his first album, and I asked if anyone knew where Rick Wakeman had recently said that ARW is back on for more concerts next year. Paul Rogers, not that Paul Rogers, says Rick talked about it on stage at one of his concerts this week, but I can't find any official confirmation of that anywhere as yet. Recent guest on the show, Miguel Falcao, has released his latest video. It's Madrigal from that Yes album. What is it? Oh yeah, Tomato. He plays the bass pedals on it, and it's another fascinating one to watch. Preston Frazier has reviewed The Solution from Open Your Eyes this week, and he likes it. Paul Watson reminded us all that the new Yes 50 Live album is on its way soon. Actually today, as I record this, and Geoffrey Mason posted a selfie at the Dave Watkinson Yes plaque in London. Excellent. Incidentally, I've just looked at the Rhino Records website, and it looks like the Yes 50 Live album has been pushed back to the 2nd of August. In the visitor posts, Doug Curran added his Lark's Tongues in Aspic signed LP, and Bob Keeley asks about the backstory to the John Anderson Earth Nature opus. You may have seen the videos on YouTube of this instrumental music, but it appears to have surfaced with little explanation. There's an hour and a half of music over four videos with footage of natural scenes. The Best Yes and related internet source Henry Potts' Where Are They Now site has this explanation. Anderson has released four related instrumental long-form pieces free online. Opus 1, Hopefulness, which is 30 minutes and 48 seconds. Opus number 2, Joyfulness, 25:20. Opus number 3, Thankfulness, 21 minutes. And opus number 4, Gratefulness, 19 minutes and 6 seconds. Visuals for Hopefulness and presumably the others are by Michael Byrne, Papercut, who said, originally called Piano Lessons, Anderson spoke of Rachmaninoff and music. Hopefulness was released first in June 2019 on a Google Drive entitled Piano Lesson 2020 and announced via Facebook. It's also available on Anderson's SoundCloud under the name The Hopeless Opus. The other three came on separate days, 6th and 11th of July. So all a bit confusing and not a lot of detail, as is the usual case with John. Jamie McQuinn wore his rather splendid Lark's Tongues in Aspic t-shirt to listen to last week's episode, and there was a great discussion on the show notes for last week as well, from Jamie, Ian NB, John Thompson, Doug Curran and Joseph Cottrell. Do go and enjoy that. Over on Twitter, Jeremy North is riding his bicycle in France currently, and Simon Barrow was musing about the use of silence in Yes music. It was Trevor Horn's birthday, and despite having to be brought back from the dead, remember that, Prog magazine hit 100 issues, which is a remarkable achievement. This week's first voicemail comes from John Cowan, and here it is.
Hello, Kevin. This is John, over here in Florida. Just want to give you my thoughts on attending the Royal Affair tour, which I did. And it was last Friday night, and I have to tell you, it was amazing. Probably the one of the better shows I've ever seen, really, with all the bands. With Carl Palmer was unbelievable how good he still is. And, of course, John Lodge, and it was good to see John Davison get up. I don't know what song they sang together, but John Davison came out and sang a song with him, too. And I've heard the song before. I just don't know the name of it. And then, of course, Asia was good, and Asia was absolutely great. And then, of course, Yes took the night. It was a very, 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 very wonderful show. And, you know, to be honest with you, Steve was really on his best behavior because he didn't admonish the audience at all. They were very good. Everybody was well-behaved, obviously. He even commented at the end of the show what a great audience we were. And it was very appreciated, of course. But the highlight of the night probably for me was when I met Roger Dean. When I walked into the venue, I saw his canopy with his paint name on it and stuff. And he was sitting all by himself. And I don't know if anyone knew who he was or what was going on, but I walked up to him and he saw my shirt and he smiled. And I said, told him, I says, I am a patron on the Yes Music Podcast, allegedly. He got a good laugh out of that. And we continued talking. He signed my program for me and I really appreciated that. But I'm telling you, and musically, the highlight of the night was definitely when during Gates, during the battle scene, watching Steve and Billy interact with each other. It was great. It really was. You could tell they were really into jamming on that song. That's all, Kevin. I just wanted to give you a brief synopsis of the show that I thought was great. And if anyone has a chance, please go see this show. Please see it. It is the best show you're going to see. Definitely the hot show of the year. Thank you very much.
Roger Dean, always a gent. Thanks for that, John. And the second voicemail came from Bill Light.
Hi, this is Bill Light. Last night I saw the Royal Affair tour and just wanted to give you my thoughts. I thought that Yes was excellent. It seems that they really found their footing with the current members, except for Alan White, who obviously is not well. I thought Carl Palmer was excellent. The biggest disappointment was Asia. Bumblefoot is absolutely horrible, to be frank. It's one thing for them not to be able to replace John Wetton, but it's another thing to pick a guy who is just not a good vocalist. You would think that even if they scoured the internet for a cover band, they could come up with somebody who vocally would be superior to Bumblefoot. John Lodge was also somewhat weak vocally. He just is obviously not Justin Hayward in terms of his ability to project as a vocalist. But again, I thought Yes was great and really enjoyed the show overall.
Thanks, Bill. Interesting to hear your alternative views, and that's exactly what we want. Glad you thought Yes were good, though. Shame one concert was cancelled due to potentially dangerous weather this past week. Hopefully those who missed out on that will get another chance. Finally for this section, Nick Moyart sent in a mocked-up Roundabout the Movie poster, which I've included in the show notes for this episode. It was after he went to see the film yesterday. Nice work, Nick. And of course, thank you to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week. Yes are currently playing the Gates of Delirium on the Royal Affair tour, so we thought it was time to listen to previous live versions of the song. Part of the reason for a lot of the excitement about this song re-entering the live repertoire is that it has not been played live by the band alone since the 4th of October 2000 in Cincinnati, Ohio, at the Riverbend Music Center Amphitheatre, which is about 19 years ago. I had wrongly assumed that the last time it was played by the band alone was on the 22nd of August 1976 in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at the Allen County War Memorial Coliseum, with Patrick Mraz on keyboards. I had completely forgotten about the Masterworks tour, which was after Billy Sherwood left the band, but while Igor Khoroshev was still providing the keys role. This tour was a deliberate return to long-form Yes music, but it didn't make it to the UK, which is probably why I forgot about it. I've heard Gates live myself, but on the symphonic tour, so it was augmented brilliantly by orchestra and Tom Brislin on keyboards. But that was inevitably a rather different kind of performance to the one we've got on the current tour. Forgotten Yesterdays contains a fascinating comment from a fan who witnessed the final outing of Gates before 2019 at the Apollo Theatre in Manchester, UK, on the 13th of December 2001. It reads, "Yes, we got Gates, thanks to a guy called Terry Higginbottom. This guy, John told us, had written to him to express his disappointment at Gates being omitted last time round, so John dedicated it to him. Thank you, Terry Higginbotton, whoever you are. I was a person who voted against the orchestra, but I will happily eat my words at this moment. John's brother was there tonight, I think he lives in Manchester, and he, John, seemed to be very happy on stage. Chris had an intense, mischievous look on his face throughout, and he played off the crowd during ritual. John forgot the words at the beginning of Close to the Edge, but apologised in between songs. All in all, worth every penny, and in honesty, my thoughts go out to those fans who were denied Gates, as this was absolutely spectacular. The piece was dropped from the November 28th Manchester show. However, we will return to the symphonic tour a little later on. First, we need to consider the Yes show's live version, which was the first officially released recording of Gates Live. The Chris Squire-curated Yes shows has always been a controversial live album, somewhat in the shadow of the mighty Yes songs, but it's long been a favourite of mine. It contains performances from the 76, 77 and 78 tours, from dates in North America and Europe. Its version of Gates was recorded at Cobo Hall in Detroit, Michigan on the 17th of August 1976, and therefore featured John Anderson, Chris Squire, Steve Howe, Alan White and Patrick Mraz. I've always really liked the sound and mix on Yes shows, but I realise I'm not necessarily in the majority on that. The opening of Gates of Delirium sounds fabulous to my ears. There are clearly some tapes or automatic settings adding some of the keyboard patterns which couldn't have been replicated live, and that's fair enough, but Mraz's creative and unusual keys when combined with the heavy and sonorous bass, set against the by turns spiky and then smooth harmonics-infused Telecaster of Howe, and the paradiddling white cymbals creates a mesmerising effect, even more affecting than the studio version for me. The balance between parts is great, with each one clearly audible. There are some very tricky corners in the music which are not perfectly performed, but when the stand-and-fight vocals begin, we are off to the races with inexorable forward motion and can bathe in the wonderful complexity of the arrangement. Anderson vocals are powerful and insistent, but the juxtaposition of the instrumental parts creates one of the most startling textures in progressive rock. The sound is clean and clear, and the precise virtuosic playing a delight. Highlights include the interplay between guitar and synth, with the rhythm section weaving in and out of the tapestry. Howe uses the character of the Telecaster to great effect. It's as if he's always used this guitar. Squire adds high bass lines which illustrate the music rather than just plonking along, as other players might have done. White's drumming is amongst my very favourite of his, and while it's not in the same style as Bruford, it's clearly just as complex, defined and perfectly suited to this music, as, for example, Bill's was, to Close to the Edge. This is a perfect example of the equal status of all band members, as Mraz takes the centre stage with his synth solo, and then Howe wrests the spotlight from him, only to return it shortly afterwards. The most famous guitar-keyboard trading is between Howe and Wakeman, perhaps, but the so-called battle scene, as recorded on Yes shows, is just as compelling as White and Squire hold it all together. It's one of the most exciting passages of Yes music, and you'll always get my vote if you manage to highlight Squire's fast and furious lines. He whizzes around the bass like a demon, and this section is tight. The rivalries between Yes and King Crimson, as well as other bands, are legendary, and I wonder what competing musicians thought when they heard Gates, particularly in this recording. This is shockingly dynamic and multi-layered, the product of five musicians at their creative zenith. Will Romano, in his book Close to the Edge, How Yes's Masterpiece Defined Prog Rock, argues that a lot of bands fall into a trap after creating their most important work. So in Tales from Topographic Oceans and Relayer, he feels Yes have become too self-aware. They try to do a Yes rather than be Yes. They try to produce what they think Yes music should be rather than letting it flow naturally. I have to say I don't get that impression from this recording of Gates Live. It feels like the band are possessed by a creative force, and this is no more evidence than when the battle scene moves into the massive keyboard theme. Mraz is a wizard on the pitch wheel, and Howe matches his note bending on the guitar as Squire plays counter-melodic epic lines in between. The music finally ebbs to reveal the preamble to the soon section, and the control of the band is remarkable. This passage could quite easily descend into aimless-sounding waffle, but they manage to preserve its poise and elegance as Howe eventually declaims the sliding delay pedal-enhanced guitar theme. It's a spine-tingling moment when Anderson takes on the soon melody, which would be much less affecting if it wasn't for the Squire mobile bass part, Howe's beautiful long lines, and Mraz's deft keyboard touches. One of the defining Order Out of Chaos transitions, which then builds with mellotron and guitar towards another iteration of that wonderful Anderson line, and then the playout, which ramps up and up before a tender and heartfelt ending. What a trip. So now on to the Masterworks Tour version with Igor Koroshev on keyboards. His sounds are quite different to Mraz's, and some of the patterns he includes at the beginning are also his own versions, but it all sounds good, even though it's definitely something which moves away from the original and sounds rather updated in the keys department. This soundboard recording is a good one, and it's been scrubbed up and remastered on this YouTube video with plenty of bass. Igor does very well to play in unison with Howe, and when Anderson's vocals come in, we're off, albeit with some definitely 2000s keyboard sounds rather than 1970s. I don't dislike them at all, however. The band seems very well put together, with Alan White still managing his original parts brilliantly. Koroshev blends Hammond organ sounds in with synth, and it all rocks along with very powerful Anderson lead vocals. As has been said elsewhere, Koroshev is the most nimble and also creative full keyboard member of the band besides Wakeman, and he really comes into his own in this piece. Perhaps some musical corners don't come off quite as well as on the record, but Igor's synth soloing is epic, fabulously dexterous and retaining a lot of the original's feel, whilst also throwing in his character as well. Every note in each fast and furious run is precise and perfectly executed. It's great to be able to hear every drum stroke, and White is turning it up to 11 with energy and precision. I feel very jealous I was unable to witness this tour, as I think the band sounds like it was as tight and together as I've ever heard it. Igor throws in a huge pitch bend before that epic theme set against Howe, which is a real prog-tastic synth triumph with his identity all over it. All in all, it's a huge treat to hear this version. The soon ending is very well controlled, and Koroshev again embellishes the original quite a bit, with science fiction-sounding washes of synth. Howe's iconic guitar theme isn't at all diminished, and Anderson sings the melody in the way only he can. It's a lovely ending to a great performance, just as good as the Yes Show's one in its own way. So now we need to move on to the Symphonic Live version of Gates. The CD which I'm listening to is the 2009 double disc version, which is a good job, because the single disc version doesn't have Gates on it. This is the soundtrack from the wonderful DVD which was recorded at the Heineken Music Hall in Amsterdam on the 22nd of November 2001, with the European Festival Orchestra conducted by Wilhelm Keitel. That's the same lineup as I saw myself. The great youthful orchestra backing Tom Brislin, John Anderson, Alan White, Chris Squire and Steve Howe. Back in 2001 I had no access to set lists in the way we do now, so when the opening notes of Gates of Delirium sprang to my ears, I was amazed that amongst all the other large-scale pieces in the concert, they were now to play this amazing piece with a full orchestra. On this recording each instrument is clearly audible, so Howe and Squire in particular are very well represented at the beginning. One of the big questions here is clearly how can the orchestra and Tom Brislin replicate Patrick Mraz's parts? I have to say it's done startlingly well. Brislin comes in with the essential synth parts and the orchestration is superb. It's an amazing reimagining of the original, with swirling strings and brass setting off the sparkling and multi-layered scene for Anderson vocals which cut through superbly. Strings add rising figures and Squire's bass is enhanced with some low brass. It never tips into parody, and the vast soundscape possible with this instrumentation fits the music perfectly. Howe might be slightly sunk into the mix at some points, but the overall effect is brilliant. Brislin flies around the keyboards, note and timing perfect, and the sense of motion is incredible. It's a huge juggernaut of sound, with band and orchestra very well balanced, letting the towering Squire lines through as Howe keeps it all rock solid beneath. It's impossible not to nod your head along to the rhythm and bask in the music. The changes of tempo and feel are navigated seamlessly, with the sweeping strings and fluttering woodwind producing deep textures highly appropriate for this piece. The orchestration doesn't detract from what the band is doing in important passages, and Brislin's synth tones are perfect. As we move towards the battle scene section, the mood ramps up with brass used particularly effectively to soar and push the feel forward. Howe's guitar antics are clear in the mix, and Brislin's keyboard soloing is fantastic, with orchestra and that massive bass line rumbling and leaping along. I suppose Brislin could have been highlighted a little bit more, but that's a minor detracting factor, and the way his parts are embedded into the music does work really well. The sense of energy and drive is almost overwhelming, and I'm absolutely convinced this piece is a perfect vehicle for this instrumentation. Brislin's pitch bending is wonderful, and Alan White blasts out his own elaborate and intricate parts with abandon. It's a joy to hear. The orchestra answers Howe's phrases in a highly effective fashion, and it's such an immersive experience, enhanced by the added instruments. That order out of chaos at the end of the battle is brilliantly handled, with strings playing the massive theme alongside Brislin's warping and pulsating keyboards. Every note you would want to hear is included in appropriate additions from the orchestra, just serve to enhance the remarkable experience. The recording and production is fantastic, and in some ways I prefer this version to the DVD, as I find I can concentrate on the music more easily. The ebbing to the quiet section comes off beautifully, with the quiet strings in the background and harp adding real Yes magic. Washes of cymbals lead to that incomparable soon guitar theme from Howe, and the keyboard, orchestra, orchestral harp combination is truly mesmerising. Anderson's acoustic strumming is a little abrupt, but his vocals more than make up for it, as the transformational power of the melody envelops the listener, with the guitar and bass intertwining in their wondrous counter-melodic patterns. It's one of the most deeply affecting performances of a Yes song I can think of. The scale and depth of the music benefits from the orchestra enormously, and Howe in particular is precise and dynamic. The ending seems to embody the true essence of what Yes music is about for me, with a sense of awe spreading inexorably throughout the mind, body and spirit. So three very different performances of Gates of Delirium, but all of them wonderful in their own ways. Which one do you prefer?
Greetings, friends. So last week, during our Two Pence segment, we discussed a little bit about Gates of Delirium being put back into the set for the Royal Affair tour. So we decided, what better song to talk about this week than Gates of Delirium? And we're going to take a look at three different versions of it that were done live. One from the Yes shows in 1980, one from the Masterworks tour in 2000, and one performance of it from the 2001 Symphonic tour. Now, before I start looking at the individual performances, I just got to say that Gates of Delirium to me is one of the hallmark songs for Yes. It definitely stands out in their catalog as being possibly one of the strongest songs they've ever written. Throughout the years, they've only chosen to play the ending section, which is soon, for live performances. And, you know, when I think about it, it's most likely because it is a complex song. I mean, when you take a listen to the performances they've done on some of these versions, and it's not an easy song to perform. So obviously, that's one thing to consider, the possibility of it being a difficult song to perform every night on a tour. Also, I think the other part of it that one has to think about is it is over 20 minutes long. So you are looking at possibly two or maybe three songs that could be put in there in place of Gates of Delirium. Well, knowing Yes and how long some of their songs are, maybe it'll just be one or two songs more likely. But I feel that putting Gates of Delirium back into the set list will make quite a few Yes fans very happy. I'm very sure of that. So let's first take a look at the performance from the Yes shows. The Yes shows album was released on November 24, 1980, and the mixes were supervised by Chris Squire, which is something I'll get back to in a few minutes. Overall, the performance of this song is really good and very tight performance. I like the guitar sound on this version much better than the studio version, even though Relayer is my favorite Yes album. The one thing that I've always kind of had a little bit of a beef of with Relayer is I think that Steve's guitar sound is a little harsh sometimes. Like, because he does use a Telecaster, that was always have a tendency of having a pretty bright sound to it. And in some of the parts of the song, it can sound really, really harsh. But in the live version, I think that they did a good job of toning down the harshness, and it sounds really fantastic. The vocal harmonies are really well done in this. They are spot on pitch, and Alan's performance of this song is really fantastic. John's vocal range is very good on this. There's no evidence of any kind of straining or anything like that. Obviously, we're at a point still in John's career where he has a very, very strong voice and can hit pretty much anything. But quite possibly my favorite part of this whole song, which is the middle section, is done very well on this version between Steve and Patrick. The interplay and the back and forth between them is very well done. Patrick's Moog sounds are really well done. And back then, there was also quite a bit of problems sometimes with tuning and pitch with the Moogs, but he's done a fantastic job of keeping them in check. The ending of this song, which is soon, is one of the best versions of it, I think, that they've done on record. very well played. The mood of it especially is really well done. I like the way they brought it down from the battle section into this. Usually those kind of transitions can be a little shaky sometimes, but they really tackled it very well. It transitions very smoothly between the very upbeat part to this very slow and mellow part. It has to be said, though, that Chris Squire's bass playing in this is really, really good. I like the little melody lines that he's added in to this. And Steve Howe's slide playing, as usual, is very good on this. It adds so much emotion to the song. Now, the interesting thing about this is, while I feel that this is probably one of the better recorded performances of it, when we look back into history and look through the notes, there's quite a bit mentioned about the actual recording of this album. Chris Squire is noted to be going through hours of tape, picking out the best performances for the Yes Show's album. By the end, he picked out 5 dates from 1976, 77, and 78, and used those 5 concert dates that he thought were the strongest and mixed the album at his Sun Park studio. Once the mixes were done, apparently Steve Howe really didn't like it and objected strongly at some of the production edits that he did and wanted to go back in and quote-unquote refine the recordings. In other words, he wanted to go back in and overdub and, you know, polish up the performances a bit. Whether they have a version of that or not, I don't know, but it is noted that they didn't get around to doing that, I don't think. If they did, they never put that version out, because when the band split in 1981, Atlantic Records went ahead and took Chris Squire's original mixes, got them mastered, and released it as Yes Shows. The next performance is from the Masterworks tour. This performance is from July 19th, 2000. And this tour, as we know, is the last tour with Igor Khorishev, which to me has always been a sore point, because I feel that Igor is probably one of the best keyboard players Yes ever had. Right up there with Rick Wakeman, in my opinion. With that said, I think his performance of this song is very strong. In fact, I'd say he's probably the best performer on this song. He covers a lot of keyboard parts on this, more than maybe Patrick did in the Yes Show's performance. Like I said, still, that performance is really fantastic. But this one, I think, is marginally better, because I think Igor adds a bit more to it. And his classical training is just very evident on this song. The rest of the band holds up pretty well, obviously. I'm guessing that this has probably been a while since they'd done this song live. Steve has a few parts where he kind of stumbles a little bit. Nothing really major, just a little timing issue here and there. John's singing, I think, is fantastic. He did a great job singing this song, and I think Alan's drumming is really, really good on this version. This is still when Alan's back has not been really too big an issue, so his performances are still very strong and just fantastic. When Alan's on fire and when he's in the groove, it really benefits the band, I feel, and this is one of those songs where we see that, especially in the middle battle section. His drumming is very good on that, very impactful, and it really gives that battle sequence the sort of power that it needs. Now, the last performance is from the Symphonic Live in 2001. Now, this has always been my favorite version of this song, mainly for 2 reasons. One, Tom Brislin did a fantastic job on keyboards. He recreated a lot of Patrick Mraz's keyboard sounds and recreated his actual lines absolutely perfectly. He's a very underrated keyboard player, I think, overall. He did such a great job on this song, and pretty much the whole concert, I think he did a great job. In fact, I wouldn't have been surprised if Rick Wakeman, if he would have heard this performance, maybe might have started rethinking about maybe coming back to the band a little sooner than maybe he anticipated. I think that if they would have stuck with Tom a little bit longer, I think he would have really dug his roots in, and I think that he would have probably been in there for a very long time. But the other reason why I think this version of Gates is so fantastic and is my favorite performance is because of the orchestra. The orchestra really adds a lot to this version. Especially during those battle sections, they really make the song very epic. That's exactly what the keyboards were trying to do back in the day, in the 70s and even in 2000, when Igor Khorishev was trying to recreate those sections. But, one man and a few keyboards can't recreate what a 20 or 30 piece orchestra can do on stage. And it's very evident in this version of it. Besides that, you know, the vocals are fantastic on this. The guitar playing is very good on this too. The slide playing is good. The vocal harmonies are fantastic as well. And also, it's interesting to make note that John Anderson's percussion section that he has in the back there that he always goes to when he doesn't have to sing also added a lot. He has a lot of different cymbals and bells and hand percussions and blocks and stuff like that that he can add a lot to this song and did add a lot to this song. So those kind of things always make an epic song like Gates that much better sounding. So while it's maybe unfair to compare the 1976 version of it to this version, I still say that overall this is my favorite version of it because of all these reasons that I've mentioned.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
So it's brilliant to be able to speak to Tim Morse, the creator of this book here. Now, Yes Stories, Yes in their own words, Tim Morse. Not in print anymore, but we'll be asking Tim about that in a minute. It's actually the first Yes. It is a book that I actually constantly use when I'm preparing episodes of the podcast, because it's just fantastic to pick up and find, you know, it's in chronological order, and almost every topic that you talk about is covered in some way in the book. But of course, it only goes as far as 95, 96, that sort of time. That's correct. You ever thought about updating it in a new edition?
Yeah, it comes up every now and again. I think the more likely thing would be to do an ebook, and I have given that some thought, and there might be some updated information. I've also thought about possibly collecting the work that I've done past Yes Stories. I've done lots of magazine articles with the guys and internet interviews, and I thought I might be able to package that all together and again maybe do something as an ebook, possibly something to look at in the next year or so. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it basically only covers at this point the first half of Yes's career, so many, many things have happened since then.
We better move on to your own music. So mm-hmm. You've actually just released, or most recent release that you've done is an album called Three. I think that's how you mm-hmm. put it. And I'm assuming that that's your third solo album. So tell us about that kind of journey of solo work.
I got a deal to make my first solo album in the early 2000s. And each one is their own adventure. And so the first one is very almost progressive metal. It's pretty intense. And I, you know, from that point on, I was working with a producer. I started to really hone down what I wanted to create in terms of musical vision. And so the new album, Three, is really about getting to the emotional essence of songs. So yes, it is progressive rock. And yes, there, you know, are moments of 5/4 or whatever, the things that you would associate. There's one of the cats right now. things that you would associate with progressive rock. But I wanted to get down to the core emotion, and really this is more of a singer-songwriter album than I'd say the previous one. So I'm very, very proud of the work. Mm. And it's been very well received.
Yeah. I mean, I have enjoyed listening to the samples, and I better get myself a proper copy of the thing very soon. But
I'm sure we can hook you up, Kevin.
Yeah, that'd be great. But
same here.
It does have prog elements. It does have very strong themes and songwriting and melodies and so on. You do quite a number of the different roles, though, don't you? You play keyboards, you play guitars, you sing. Is that right?
Yeah, I do all of those things. And I play quite a bit of bass on this album as well. And drums on two songs, which was a bit of a stretch, but I thought it'd be fun to on the easier songs anyway, to have a bash at the drums. So yeah, it's fun to explore those things. In fact, cats are visiting. the original vision for the album was to do something a la McCartney One, where I played everything. And after I started doing the demos, I thought, no, I'd like to have some cameos, some other voices here. So I did invite some guests to play.
Yeah. Huh. Well, Mark, you're going to be a kindred spirit there with Tim.
I was just going to say,
you're a solo artist as well.
Oh,
yeah. I was going to say that me and you have a lot in common, because I mean, I'm working on my fourth album actually, and all three of them so far I've done completely on my own, from drums to vocals, keyboards, bass, singing, everything I did myself. So I can totally relate with what you're talking about as far as the songwriting goes. And I have to say, I've been listening to songs off of three, and I really enjoyed it quite a bit actually. Especially like the Mary Celeste song was very good. I thought that there's some fantastic playing. I mean, I hear a lot of different influences, especially on the keyboards. I thought I heard a little bit of a sort of a Patrick Mraz kind of influence in spots. And I've also heard like some Genesis and some Spock's beard and stuff like that in there as well. And what I'm really fascinated to ask you though, because you did mention that the first record that you did, it was sort of more of a metal sort of progressive record. And that's sort of along the genre that I'm kind of in right now with my music as well. So apart from Yes, who would you count amongst your influences then?
That's another great question. Well, you said Genesis, and I think as far as, you know, musical influence that spills over into my own writing and arranging and playing, the music of Genesis is definitely, you know, high on that list. I'm not courting it, but you know how it is. It sort of spills out of you, you know? You can't help it. A keyboardist named David Sanchez is also an important influence. He played with John at one time. Mm-hmm. A very important influence for me, and a friend. And it's great too. I promoted a show with David. You get to being with your keyboard guru, you know, and ask him all those questions that you wanted to ask, whatever. Other artists that maybe not necessarily we would associate with progressive rock, but for instance, Kate Bush is a huge icon for me. I went to see her last two shows in England when she was performing a few years ago, an artistic experience of a lifetime to go and see Kate perform. Mm. So there's lots of things, and things that you wouldn't necessarily see against maybe spilling, but I've become a fan of Latin jazz, let's say, in the last few years. And so Joe Beam and Gilberto and people like that. Well, maybe if you listen close to like the rhythm or the melody of something, you might be able to hear a little bit of that seeping in. Yeah. So we're influenced by everything all around us. But those are some major influences. Oh, Kevin Gilbert. I need to say Kevin Gilbert.
Hmm. Okay, fantastic. Well, you've mentioned John Anderson there. And you have a kind of bonus disc, don't you, that anyone buying something from your website gets this bonus disc. And one of those songs on there is something called Opening. Now, John Anderson, opening, tell us what that's all about.
Right. So end of 2010, there was some talk. Again, John and I have a friend in common. And there was a little talk in that time that maybe John would use my band for live performances. So we talked a little bit about it, and then he quickly got on to the idea of possibly collaborating with him on some music that he'd been writing. Of course, I was tremendously excited. And so he sent me four of these pieces, which then, of course, I found out that he had sent to many collaborators. But one was The Knowing. One was Open, which was at that time called Opening. And then two other pieces that I don't believe he's done anything with. So I guess I'm not going to say anything about them right now. So he sent me these pieces and I was very impressed. Obviously, you know, even in their demo stage, there was a lot there. And so he gave them to me, and then he promptly, I think, went on vacation to Kauai. He's like, okay, so I'll see you later. Basically, nothing had been transcribed, so I had to sit and, you know, by ear, map out what he had written with Open. He had done, I believe, everything on him. So he had played a MIDI guitar, and he was singing the lines over the top of it. Whereas the other piece, he had had a pianist. I'm sorry, I don't know who it was. And they had written the rough ideas of what The Knowing and other things were. So I scored it out, and then he said the first one he wanted me to work on was Opening. So we traded ideas back and forth, and I got a real taste for how John works. And it was tremendously exciting to work with one of your heroes in that sort of intimate way. And you get a sense, again, of how quickly he's an extraordinarily creative person, how quickly he moves from one idea to the next idea. And you know, you want to pull him back. You're going to rein him in a little bit. You can see how, with the guys, it must have been very frustrating at times working with John when he's flitting off to the next idea, and they're like, no, come back. So there was a little bit that I could see with the work he did with Rowena Stoll when they finally did release a version of The Knowing.
Yeah.
It looked like Rowena basically let John get on with whatever idea he had, you know, it was realized. But we did work on opening, and it was very exciting. There was kind of an ebb and a flow, and he started to find it became more and more grandiose. Let me put it that way. You know, if he wanted to do an album or, you know, music that sounded like Yes, then I think I'm very qualified to do that. But then it was, okay, well, there's going to be a small choir and, you know, possibly a string section. Okay, I can arrange for that. And then you see where this is going, you know. And then it wants, you know, then it's going to be a full orchestra, you know, and he's sending me examples of Stravinsky, and I'm thinking, I'm not sure I'm still your right guy, you know. And it was about that time that he said basically the same thing. He said, you know, no reflection on you. I need to work with someone who's close to me, proximity. And he found that person to do the final work on opening that became open. And they did a lovely job. I'm partial to my version, but it was nice to see it get released.
Excellent. So if anyone buys something from your site, you'll send them that amongst an enormous collection of other things as well, demos and different versions of songs.
Yeah, it's a full disc, actually. I think it's easily 60 minutes. It might even be 70 minutes worth of things that I'm sure, Mark, you have this too, where there's lots of songs lying around where it's a cover version or a live thing or, you know, a demo or whatever, and you think, gosh, it'd be great to put this out in some way. And that was the easiest album I ever put together because everything was done. All I had to do was assemble it and master it.
Yeah, so the last question we've got in the time that we've got today is I was going to ask you about the future, books, music, playing live. Do you have any firm plans yet?
No, not firm plans. I'm still finishing the promotion for 3. There's another video that has to be made and a couple other things related to that. And I'm starting to accumulate music and decide what the next project. I was thinking there was a possibility of doing maybe a fusion album, an instrumental album where there wouldn't be vocals and lyrics, and that would save a lot of time, frankly. I didn't have to worry about the lyrics and the vocal. I could get an album done in, I'll say, you know, a few months. I don't know if that's true or not. But the other side of it is possibly doing like a big progressive rock extravaganza where, you know, 3 was about the emotional essence of a song, and this would be, you know, the kitchen sink, right? All the fiddle faddling that I didn't do last time would be in this project. So right now it could be one or the other. I'm kind of leaning more to the full blown progressive rock album. As far as the books go, I've had a little project on the back burner for a while, and it may stay there for another year. So I wanted to do a biography on an important musician to me. And I don't want to say too much more about it, but you know, maybe in the next year or so that will get looked at. And the other things, like we were saying with the ebook of Yes stories, possibly another related Yes book could be coming down the pipeline.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's been absolutely delightful to meet you, Tim. Absolutely fantastic time we've had. And we will have you back, of course. But now we need to get on as a group and read your fantastic Yes stories book with the hope that we will have an electronic version and an updated version as soon as possible. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed for your time, Tim.
It's been a pleasure.
Hello, this is Roger Dean, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Allegedly.
Just before we go, here's the patron update. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, VR Hoisington, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music Podcast patrons, or rather half of them, are Mark James Lang, Martin Kjellberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkal Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, William Hayes, and Michael Handahan. Also continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them and see things like that video this week of Tim Morse, then head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening again so much. I do hope we'll be back next week, but in the meantime, you can follow the show on the website, yesmusicpodcast.com, on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.